The previous program was the Gary Knoll Show, heard Monday through Friday at noon. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind coming up. It is 1 p.m. Stay tuned.
Ben Starr and Kevin O'Donohue here with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today we're bringing you some difficult concepts and a fantastic guest who you know to talk about a difficult subject, one that has been on a lot of people's mind lately, one that has touched countless lives, has affected many, many people, many, many families, and one that is important for us to talk about and get out there in the open. We're here to talk about suicide. Here with Kevin O'Donohue and our guest today, Dr. Kent Robertshaw. Kent, thank you so much for being here, as always.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Good to be back, Ben. And it is a serious topic, but it's a topic people don't talk about. You know, back in 1971, WBAI got a caller in to the station. Bob Foss was on the air at the time. And Bob Foss handled this guy marvelously. I don't know if you've listened to it, but we're going to play a little piece from that today, and then we're going to talk about the stigma of suicide. What is that word when we say it, when you say it to yourself, when you hear of somebody's suicide? What does that word do to you? What does it do? So it's a topic that needs to be talked about. There is information from a mental health side that we feel the public should know about. That if the public is educated about the signs of people that they care about that are being reflected, that, you know, it's important to be well informed, because suicide can be stopped. It can be interrupted. And the loved ones are the best ones to do that. So we feel like the WBA audience really needs this information. And we're going to be bringing it to you. We're going to try and do a full one-hour treatment about suicide, somebody taking their own life. Is it just anger? You know, depression, is depression anger turned inward, and that's all it is that suicide is? Well, it really isn't. It's more than that, much, much, much more than that. So we're going to play this little bit from 1971, Bob Foss handling this caller.
And for those of you who are longtime WBI listeners, no doubt you've tuned into Radio Enable, and you are a fan of what Bob does. This is from a documentary that was made about Bob and the show called Radio Enable. And so we wanted to just bring you this segment where Bob is talking to a caller who was suicidal. Because it is one of the legendary phone calls that's ever been made into this station.
Yeah, okay. I won't spoil this surprise.
Listen, I've always liked BAI.
Yeah?
Are you a gentleman?
I don't know what a gentleman means.
Well, I'm in the process of committing suicide, and maybe this would help BAI, you know, to collect money or something.
BAI was having a fund drive that wasn't terribly successful.
But don't turn me in or
I don't mean that.
On my number or anything like that.
You're in the process of committing suicide.
That's a crime.
That's a what?
It's
a crime. All my life I've wanted to commit a crime. At last I succeeded.
I didn't believe him, of course, at first. But I spoke to him and I didn't hang up on him for some reason.
Why? I mean, you know,
a conjury of things, including a final rejection from a girlfriend, tried as all that.
Oh, well, that'll really teach her, won't it?
Teach her or me?
Her. It'll teach you, I guess.
Yeah, teach me.
How are you going to do it?
I've done it, I'm sorry to say.
What do you mean?
I've taken an amalgam of pills. One shape or another, death has been in my mind since I was 16, younger.
Well, I mean, I don't think that's even unique. I think everyone has been struggling against the awareness of death.
I hope you can use this whole thing in some way. I'm going to hang up.
Well, wait a minute. The worst thing that can happen is somebody will stop you from doing this thing, and then you'll have another chance to do it later. Talk to me. It takes about 20 minutes to trace a call, and you haven't been on the phone with us for 3 minutes yet.
You're telling me the truth?
I'm telling you the truth.
It takes a long time.
Oh, because the telephone company is more messed up than your life is, and they're not about to commit suicide.
In those days, the only way that a call could be traced was for someone to go through the central switchboard and listen in on every call and see if that was the call that we were making. We knew they would be able to narrow it down to a neighborhood, but that's still thousands in New York City of telephones.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Please try to stand up. Do it. You can do it. Just get up on your feet. Pitch yourself up on your feet.
Feet?
Yeah.
His voice began to get slurry.
Stand up. Come on, stand up. Hello? What'd you say your name was?
Stanley.
Stanley what? Stanley Kaufman?
By the second or third hour, the guy had fallen asleep, and you could hear him breathing.
Stanley? Hey, Stanley!
And I took the call off the air, and I said, play music into the line. Play music into it loud. Maybe you can wake the guy up. It took 8 hours. 8 hours. Before they could find the line. And then finally, they did.
And fortunately, the gentleman was able to make it. And we wanted to share that today as we discuss the difficult topic of suicide to demonstrate how positively and how strong Bob was when he handled that, because the most important thing is to be persistent and to never give up on someone who's exhibiting that kind of hopelessness.
And to be present, Ben, you know. He was present with him. He even had a sense of humor, you know. Your life can't be more screwed up than the New York Telephone Company at the time. So Bob didn't panic, you know. And I think what happens with this conversation is that people panic. And, you know, it's happening. There are over 800,000 suicides a year worldwide. 800,000, more than any murders, car accidents, death by animals, and, you know, all sorts of natural catastrophes, more than anything, and yet people do not talk about this. It's the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. So we need to know what the risk factors are, what the warning signs are, what the treatments are. And that's what we want to bring to you today. We also want to hear from you. We want to hear you. Looking back, if you've had a person who committed suicide in your life, looking back on it, did you notice some signs? The signs that we're going to mention, but there might be other signs. Bob was noticing this gentleman, Stanley, talked about having this notion of death since he was 16 years of age. How many people do you know are walking around thinking, like, struggling, really, daily, with the thought of suicide in their head? Stanley was in his mid-40s, and yes, he did survive. But that's a lot of time to be walking around with a secret. And suicide is often, more than anything, it's a secret.
And it's like Bob said, I think we all have a concept and a contemplation of death, whether we're suicidal or not, right? Yeah. Once we gain that awareness of our own mortality, it's something that we all have to carry with us at all times.
Kent, is it a developmental thing? I mean, 10-year-olds aren't obviously aware or thinking about their own death. They're certainly not having a mood reaction to the thought of their own death. Is it a developmental thing?
Well, we know that there's a real spike in suicidal behavior in teenage years. So that I think, you know, the underlying feeling of psychological pain that people are in, sometimes there's physical pain and other sorts of things, but the kind of the feeling that people have, which again, that sleeping or not being alive is preferable to going through their day, because their day is filled with a lot of psychic pain, emotional pain, and it isn't counterbalanced by much pleasure or happiness. So we know, again, that teenage years, there's a spike in the 20s, and it really increases up until 30s or 40s, where it's, again, a very common cause of death in middle age and older. But it's not very common in children, but adolescence is the starting of those kinds of actions.
And would it be hormonal changes? I mean, obviously, when you're a teenager, I mean, does your thinking become more complicated, more complex as you enter into the teenage years?
Yeah, and I think that also teenage years, whether it's forming a sense of identity or forming a sense of self, I think younger than that, I mean, part of childhood, again, is unlimited feelings of hope and the future, you know, girls, I'm going to marry a prince, and I'm going to be an astronaut. And most children, even with very painful lives or very disruptive lives, childhoods, can still tap into this sense of, like, the hope of, you know, everything turning around, being a basketball player, a doctor, blah, 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 when you grow up. I think by teenage years, the reality and the limitations of your life come into play. And I think that can also be with a vengeance. It can be very painful when people are like, oh, I'm not going to have the kind of life that I dreamed of or I fantasized about. And day in, day out, for whatever reason, that's very complicated psychologically and biologically, they're suffering. They're in pain. And again, suicide often looking like relief of pain.
212-757-5555. It's unconscionable that teenagers are faced with this and often doing it alone. I mean, do you know a teenager who's in some sort of danger like this? Did you see a change in a teenager that you know? Is someone you know right now, currently changing right before your eyes, that might show some suicidal tendencies? Let's talk about those suicidal tendencies. But, you know, first of all, it's an awful young age. I mean, I understand the reaction of a suicide from a bullying, from being chronically bullied, because it's like an affront to your emerging identity, to trying to develop as a person. And you're being bullied, and yourself is not fully formed, and you don't have the resilience to withstand the bullying. Are you finding, like, that's a significant cause of teenage suicide?
Yes. If any of the listeners heard some of our shows about school shooting, we talked about, you know, some of the risk factors there, and almost all of them, they're planning the mass shooting to end in suicide, right? So that's like death by police fire.
Right.
So that's a subset of, you know, very depressed, hopeless teenagers who are often, again, sort of depressed, starting to get isolated, not interacting, not connecting, not in community groups, not in religious groups, not in sports groups, not in after-school activities, plays or music or whatever. So, again, it's often people who have started to isolate. Now, again, whether they're isolating because they feel not accepted and they're bullied as part of it. But then one of the cardinal symptoms of depression that's very hard for people to break through, which is when people feel so negative about themselves, they start withdrawing because they feel like they're a bummer, like they're a downer, you know, and it becomes very hard to read, you know, what's going on with them because of their own sometimes self-hatred and negative feelings about themselves. They, again, like the Woody Allen joke, I would never join a club that had me as a member. They're starting to you know, pull away from peers and the like because they feel like, you know, I just bring pain to people's life, or all I want to do is talk about negative things and people don't want to be around me. And so, again, it can, you know, this kind of social isolation, whether it's because of bullying or because of some biological, psychological sort of negative self-hatred that's starting to develop in their head.
Or social skills deficits, right? I mean, you might just be a teenager who has a hard time mixing in. You're a very shy kid.
Right.
So you don't have the skills necessarily to, you want to, you might want to be accepted and acceptable, but you don't have the skills to do it. So that naturally leads to isolation, which, as you're saying, can lead to internalizing this idea that I'm not worth anything.
If you're just joining us, you're tuned into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM, WBAI. We're talking about suicide today, and yes, because of the high-profile suicides that occurred last week, there is a conversation that is ongoing, and we do feel it's important to discuss it. But beyond the fact that two higher-profile people did commit suicide, Kevin, it's important to realize that over 100 people every day of all walks of life are choosing, you know, what is so often called a permanent solution to what could be a temporary problem.
Yeah.
And we want to address and reach out to people
yeah.
who are either struggling or whose loved ones are struggling with these kinds of thoughts.
And I think it's also important for people that are, don't know much about this, that often suicides, some suicides can be an impulsive act, that they're not thought out years in advance or even days in advance. The classic idea is that a person knows when they're going to do it, and they put their affairs in order. They start giving away their cars and their money, and they organize things, and they become neat. I mean, that is one of the classic symptoms. But a lot of times, it's an impulsive act. I mean, we know from this documentary about, what was it, some bridge where people were jumping off the bridge, and those that survived talked about realizing when they were doing it that, what am I doing? I really don't mean to do this. So it was an, I think it was the Golden Gate Bridge, this impulsive act. So many suicides can be impulsive. So a lot of people who blame themselves for not picking up the signs could be somewhat comforted with the idea that some suicides are impulsive. But, Ken, let's talk more. And we want your calls, 212-757-5555. Educate us. Educate the public. Educate everybody here in New York and around what your experience was with a suicide. It might be good for you to talk about it. Tell people about it. That's the downside of suicide, right? People don't talk about it, Kent.
Yeah, I mean, again, we professionals in the field are like everybody else. We're limited by our perception, the questions we can ask. I mean, those are our tools. And then most importantly, when we're talking about suicidal patients, people who are feeling suicidal, they sometimes are very limited about what exactly is going on, you know, what is going on inside them that they are thinking of doing an action, right? Because suicide is not feelings, right? Suicide is an action, right? It's an action. So one of the first things we do, again, we get certain questions to sort of talk about, you know, as again, did something happen, a risk factor like the call-in, a breakup often being something that would cause somebody to feel suicidal, like Ophelia with Hamlet,
right?
I mean, Ophelia, one of the most famous suicides in literature, feeling rejected or rebuffed by Hamlet. And then financial loss, job loss, self-esteem loss, medical diagnosis, chronic pain, all these things are things that are we ask about, like, did anything happen recently above and beyond, you know, chronic sort of depressed feelings, but did anything trigger things to be worse?
We have Jake on the line. Jake, are you there?
Yes, I am.
I'm good today. How are you?
Good. Good, thank you.
What's your experience with this, Jake?
Oh, I guess it started like 52 years ago. I just overcame it somehow, some way. I say it's divine grace. I have no other explanation. But, you know, around, I'll be as brief as possible. In Vietnam, I thought of shooting my foot. because there were so many catastrophes around me. I was in the infantry.
Right.
But, you know, I know that's a court-martial offense. And then I was also thinking of, me having to be wounded throughout life, whatever.
What was it about? What was it about Vietnam? I mean, were you having a hard time coping? Was it trauma? Were you exposed to a lot of death?
Exposed to, I was infantry, so it was on like a daily basis that my friends were killed or maimed.
Okay.
And then I was in a situation like the charge of the Light Brigade where there was mountains on all sides, and I thought it was the end. So whatever.
Okay.
So it went on like that, and then I came home. I was addicted to substance abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Never worked well. I had like 200-300 jobs, I don't know. Finally, I came out of the abuse, and I went, and I became, of course, I became a therapist for trauma at the VA and substance abuse.
Jake, let me jump in for a second. If someone were to observe you coming back from Vietnam, what would they have seen? Is there any warning signs that you were throwing up to people?
Oh, yeah, I was throwing police through doors and that kind of thing. You know, not your average citizen kind of thing. And I didn't want to become a citizen. I didn't want to, put taxes into, whatever.
Anti-government, anti-social, anti-people?
Yes, anti-government, anti-war. Okay. I got like 6 or 7 arrests in a year after I got back. So I think all of those signs were rather telling.
Yeah, that's a classic symptom, is to create a spectacle so that you do get noticed, so that you do get arrested, so somebody else is saving your life, locking you up, and making you safe, because you don't know how to do it yourself in some way.
Yeah, drama was a definite part of my life, but I never spent more than like 8 hours locked up. I was lucky.
Gotcha. So we got about 10 more, 15 seconds. What more can you add to this?
Okay, divine grace. Now I'm actually, the thoughts do go through my head, like someone, sorority and fraternity parties, but I didn't have that. And I'm divine. The thoughts don't hold any measure to me. Yep. I actually, after 52 years, I'm free.
Gotcha. Thank you for the call, Jake. Thanks for adding to the discussion.
It was on every in-breath and out-breath before that. Every in-breath, that's all day long, all night long.
Wow.
I'm blessed.
I'm glad you made it through all that. You had the persistence to hang in there. Thank you
for your show, and I try to tell I'm writing a book about, veterans and suicide, so that may be on the agenda soon.
Good. Thanks. Let us know when you're ready for that. Have a good day.
Okay, cool.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye now.
212-757-5555.
Again, I think that I always use, whether it's Iraq or Vietnam, to talk about the idea of post-traumatic stress disorder and how many people out there are having post-traumatic stress disorder from abuse and neglect in their childhoods, in their family life, that have the same symptoms of that caller, the same symptoms of chronic anxiety and feeling of hopelessness and lack of control over the future, and turning to substance abuse as a way to ease the pain, but often, like the celebrities that just happened, making the pain much worse.
So that's a risk factor, right? We want to distinguish risk factors from warning signs, right? A risk factor is substance abuse.
Right.
Right? If you're...
And
if you've witnessed a war. I mean, if you have, even if you're not diagnosable, you were in a situation where you would be diagnosable with PTSD, that's a risk factor. If you've been to war, you're definitely under risk of suicide, as is part of a suicidal population. 212-757-5555. We want your experience with this. We think it's important to put this topic out there, and we want to hear from our audience. 212-757-5555. We have Jonathan on the line.
Hey, my friend, how are you? This is Jonathan from the Bronx.
How are you, Jonathan?
I'm doing well, my friend.
Tell us about your experience.
Well, number one, I have personally experienced the impact of suicide by having a maternal aunt take her own life via jumping off of a bridge years ago when I was 15, my aunt Vivian.
Jonathan, and you're coming in and out on us. Is your radio on? Are you in the car?
I'm actually in the car, but let me see if I can try the situation. Is that better?
Yeah, keep going. We'll give you another try at it. We have other callers. You want to hang up and call us back?
No. Is this better?
There you go. That works.
Okay, my friend. So I was saying that as a preteen, I experienced the impact of having a maternal aunt commit suicide.
Yeah.
And the reality was that you have so many people who were completely and totally unaware of the depth of turmoil that the individual must have gone through in order to commit suicide. And so we're primarily talking about suicide with the youth today. I'm a school social worker,
okay,
and I deal with suicide prevention and intervention on a daily basis.
Tell us the five rules of prevention.
Wow. The five rules of prevention.
Yeah. How would you, as a school social worker, help a teen prevent a teen from committing suicide?
Okay. Number one, which is what I was leading to, but you
yeah, I know. We love
it. No, it's cool.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's cool.
Go ahead.
It's cool. I'm saying that, number one, I literally just finished doing a workshop today on this. So one of the things that is essential is to meet the student, the child, teenager, preteen, whatever the situation is, where they are. So in other words, to be an active listener to what their thoughts and feelings are, and to be as objective as humanly possible.
Beautiful, number
to
one.
To show respect for the humanity of their experience.
Outstanding.
That's number one. Number one. Number two, to assess what their life experience is in regards to how they perceive relationships. Okay? So, in other words, they may have a mother and father. They may have uncles and aunts. They may have cousins, family, friends, such and so forth. But it is imperative to assess the psycho-emotional intimacy of the youth with the adults in their lives. That's number two.
Jonathan, you're doing fantastic. Let me just interrupt. We're going to go to a break in a minute. Can you give us the other three as quickly as you can, and then we'll take other callers on the other side of the break?
Yes.
Go ahead. Give me number three.
Number three, I would explore spirituality in their lives, not necessarily religiosity, but spirituality.
Beautiful.
Number four, I would extend myself to them in regards to being accessible at any time of the day or evening.
Fantastic.
Number five, I would communicate to them that despite how they feel, and I would validate, I would affirm their feelings, but I would make it clear that they are not alone in that experience, and that there is help available.
We have great callers. Jonathan, you're one of our best, so thank you for calling. We're going to go to our break, and then we're going to come back and discuss these very factors.
Thank you so much.
Nice to hear from you. Take care.
Always.
Bye-bye.
212-757-5555 is the number to call. You are tuned into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM WBAI New York. Keep giving us a call. We are talking about the difficult and heavy topic of suicide today. If it's something that you've struggled with or you've watched a loved one go through, give us a call right now, 212-757-5555. We will be back after this short musical break with more of your calls.
nothing to those eastern lights. Muggy nights, the curtains drawn in the little room downstairs. Prima Donna, Lord, you really should have been there, sitting like a princess perched in her electric chair. And just one more beer and I don't hear you anymore. We've all gone crazy lately. My friends out there rolling round the basement floor. Ooh. And someone saved my life tonight. Sugar Bear.
John, someone saved my life tonight. If your life is in danger, call someone. Call someone. You can call the National Suicide Hotline, 1-800-273-8255. If you're in the New York area, again, 800-273-8255, National Suicide Hotline. If you're in the New York area, if you need immediate attention, you can call us here at the Positive Mind Center, 212-757-4488. We don't want to lose anybody. And that was about Elton John. And that was about, think of it, listen to me good. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. Listen to me good. We are here for you. And sleeping by myself. So isolation is a big factor. And having somebody available to listen to you is the safest way to cope with this. Kent, Jonathan talked about being present, being an active listener. Assess the relationships, the extent of the relationships. I really talk a little bit about that one.
Yeah, I think that he really came up with some very good things about people's experience, right? And again, very important for a person to not not to invalidate, to say you shouldn't feel that bad, you have everything to live for, that those are not helpful things. It really calls for an empathic response of how you're feeling. And obviously many people's emotional life has to do with what are the nature of the relationships in your life. He mentioned parents and adults, but obviously peers, very important as well. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the nature of the relationships that you have? And for many people, they need to talk about, you know, I don't feel well liked, or I feel bullied, or I feel no one listens to me, or no one cares about me. And that's very important for people to sort of get some empathic connection that the way they're feeling is totally valid and not wrong, and that you by definition are listening and caring right in that moment.
Exactly.
So if they're thinking no one cares about me, and there's often a fantasy when people kill themselves about people at the funeral, now I'll show them because they didn't care or they didn't know. Right then and there, you're showing empathy and care about what they're experiencing.
The solution is to be with the person. It's not to talk them out of it, to give them advice. If you give advice, think of it. If you give somebody advice and they don't take it, now they feel like a bigger failure. So the next time they see you, they can't feel comfortable because they failed your advice. So when you're confronted with somebody who wants to talk about suicide, wants to talk about what they're feeling on a deep, deep level, just being with them is the solution. I think that's enough.
Right.
And we can postpone another conversation for another time. Let's meet again. We have Catherine on the line. Catherine, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question, and I'm not a stupid person. I think I have a lot of common sense. I don't understand why, when you are such a severe alcoholic that you're constantly in the hospital, not me, my son, every 2 weeks, they don't put that together, that's suicide. Is that not suicide? Is that not, they patch you up.
So what's the deeper question you want to ask him? Think of a deep question rather than get outraged at the behavior. I understand. I definitely understand. I'm trying. How can you get close to him? What is he doing? What's the question that you really want to ask him?
Why don't they put him away? He's doing himself in.
Let's say, Catherine, you're the only one who can help him. What can you do?
I've tried everything. Nothing has worked.
So you've tried to talk to him?
Talk to him. He gets drugs in the hospital. He's on those. He's drinking. And he says he doesn't want to live. I said, well, actually, you're not going to, dear. Your liver's going to go. It's already going.
Mm.
So, I mean, I've done it all. I've done the nice. I've done the Al-Anon. I've done yelling at him. I know it
doesn't work. Have you gone with him to a professional?
He's got a psychiatrist.
Have you gone with him to the psychiatrist? Yes, I've been.
Medicaid will no longer pay for inpatient rehab. I think he just wants to go. Why can't they just lock him? I know this really sounds stupid. Why can't they just lock him up?
Yeah.
Put him away.
Yeah.
Do himself in.
Yep.
Do himself in.
I mean, it's a temptation. I mean, notice what the caretakers of loved ones feel. They feel so frustrated, Kent, that they want them locked up. And they don't know, they're at their wit's end. So what can they do? I would say that, you know, a different tactic. You need to have a softer voice, Catherine. You need to, if he's going to do this, then that's his decision, but at least he has somebody in his life up until the time that he decides to do that, that was available to him. Are you available to him?
Every day, and it's killing me, and I know it is, and I need to move on. I need to go on. I can't go with him.
All right. So I need to get a little closer to the situation. You can give me a call at my number at the office, 212-757-4488. I might see the both of you, because you sound like a lovely, caring woman, and I'm sure we just have to fine-tune how you care for him. Okay? Would you consider that?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, 212-757-5555. We have another. Again,
I think, you know, a substance abuse is one of my topics that I'm very interested in. Again, 80% of people drink socially, you know, in Colorado and lots of places. People smoke pot recreationally. It's amazing how many people can safely and occasionally use substances, right? So why is it there are people who are get into trouble, and it has to do with psychic pain, right? It has to do with an alcoholic when you're getting out of shaming them, you know. It really has to do with the question, what is it about being sober? What is it about their reality that's so painful that they're getting stoned or using Percocets or drinking, right? Mm. And many people feel hopeless and helpless. The only thing that helps my pain is substance. And we know with Spade and Bourdain, they were part of their the cocktail of things, whether it's the chicken and the egg that went into their suicide. But, you know, you have to provide hope that they're going to be able to deal with the pain that they're trying to mask and self-medicate with substances, with either talking, spirituality, or psychiatric medication, which can be very helpful for people and not have the kind of consequences and disastrous effects that substances have.
The good news for Catherine is that he is acting out, what we call in the field as acting out. You can see what he's doing. So it's so obvious that he's trying to kill himself slowly. But at least we can see it. The danger is when we don't see it. So that's good news. So, again, I encourage you, Catherine, to give us a call. We have JC on the line. Hello.
Yes, hi. Hi. This is the first time I've ever called in, so it's very emotional for me.
Okay. Relax.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're here.
I think I stopped holding. Stop breathing for a minute.
Yeah, you can breathe now. We do this for a living. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm a long-term survivor. I was clinically dead in a coma for 7 days.
You were in a coma for 7 days?
Yes, from a near-death experience, from a drug overdose.
Okay.
And I had yes.
So were you trying to overdose?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So
I almost succeeded. I think the only reason I didn't was because somebody woke up and saw me and called an ambulance, which stopped me.
What is so hard about life for you, JC?
I think back then, this is a long time ago now, this was 1974.
Okay.
I got involved with drugs, which was a bad thing to do. Kind of broke me down. Relationships got overwhelming. And I'm talking about me personally now, nobody else, because I know you have a large listening audience here in New York, including myself every day. But I think a lot of what happened, why I did what I did, why I just couldn't stay here anymore, was because I'm way too emotional. I couldn't deal with my emotions. I felt very secluded. And also I was in between two relationships, a long-term relationship with a man and also with a woman.
Okay.
I'm bisexual, and I'm talking about me personally now, nobody else.
Sure.
I think for me, being bisexual had a lot to do with.
So did you judge yourself? I mean, this sounds like a lot to handle.
You're
saying that you were taking drugs and that you were in between two relationships and not knowing. I don't know if I want to put words in your mouth, but you didn't know how to decide or which one you felt strongly for. You weren't good at expressing your emotions.
Right.
So
I also dropped out for a long time. I also was very ill physically, which had a lot to do with depression.
So how'd you get out of this?
Well, by the grace of God, I came back after 7 days in that coma, after flatlining. And I had a great near-death experience, and I literally went from heaven into hell because it's illegal to commit suicide, so they threw me into a psychiatric ward, which was horrifying.
Yeah.
And, of course, nobody spoke to me about my experience. Nobody wanted to know back then.
Even after this whole experience?
Yeah. Doctors weren't asking any questions back then. I can't even get my records from Bellevue. Yeah.
So
it was very traumatic.
So, but the symptoms haven't come back? I mean, it sounds like 40 years now you've been a survivor.
Yes.
And so somehow you found your way back to life. What is keeping you going?
I think my faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
And I always loved Jesus. So I think that has a lot to do with it. That keeps me here.
So Jonathan, our caller before the break, mentioned spirituality. So you have a really strong sense of meaning now.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Is there anything you could tell people that are in your condition, that were in your condition about 40 years ago? What would you say to them?
I think basically to love yourself. I never loved myself. I was waging an unholy war with myself.
Yeah.
And because of my background, which was so difficult, and I'm finally learning to love myself.
40 years later.
Yeah.
Hey, JC, thank you for calling us.
Thank you guys for being here. Love you.
Keep calling us.
I love you.
Kent,
too.
Is that the secret? I mean, it has to be, right? I mean, what is a self that does not love itself, right? I mean, I often think that we're multiples. We have many sides of us, many selves. Really, we talk about the self as if it's one thing. But I find people who, you know, are struggling with emotional and psychiatric disorders and conditions, they're really more than one self. There's really a war sometimes going on between selves. Can you say something about what JC talked about?
Well, again, so many people coming out of households and childhoods where there's shaming and guilt that they're not good enough, or they're being judged as not smart enough, not athletic enough, not beautiful enough, or something like that. And again, simply put, most of you out there, if you could talk to yourself the way you talk to strangers, let alone friends, your feelings about self would be so much better. The truth is, I made a mistake. I said something wrong on the radio. I beat myself up. I gained 3 pounds. I feel like a fat pig, and I don't want to go out of my house. But a friend makes a couple of mistakes, or a friend gains 15 pounds. I don't, in a way that's false, really feel like, oh, you're human. You know, come on. Everyone makes mistakes. Oh, you look good. A couple of pounds heavier. So it is true that so much psychic pain is going on in people coming out of childhoods, that their talking, their self-talk, their perception of self is always mean, critical, shame, guilt. And that's why suicide is, again, murder turned inward, where it's like, again, the world would be better off without me. I mean, I hate myself, you know, those kind of thoughts where most people around are like, you're a beautiful person, you're a wonderful person, you're a good, nice person. We don't share the same hateful, critical thoughts that often the depressed person does.
So a critical voice is a key warning sign. If you're around somebody who's constantly berating themselves, putting themselves last, talking about themselves in the negative all the time, even complaining about the world a lot, this is a classic warning sign, a person at conflict with themselves. I'm going to read off these warning signs. Talk about wanting to die. You're looking for a way to kill yourself. You're looking online, or you're buying a gun, or you're telling people about feeling hopeless. You have no reason to live. You talk about feeling trapped. That's a big warning sign. So I often ask people who are in danger of suicide, do you feel trapped? In what way are you trapped? And it dawns on them, yes, that's exactly what I'm feeling. It is. I'm feeling trapped. And when you are in a hopeless spiral, you are in a way trapped. Talking about being a burden to others. You're increasing your use of alcohol or drugs. You're acting anxious or agitated, irritability. You're sleeping too much, or you're not sleeping at all. You're withdrawing or isolating. You're showing rage. You're seeking attention. You're getting arrested. You're talking about seeking revenge. You have extreme mood swings. One thing is at the tail end of this, there's a strange condition, Kent, that people's, when they've made a decision to kill themselves, all of a sudden change personalities and become positive, right?
Yeah, well, again, you know, it's they feel peaceful because they've come up with this, as Ben started to show, this solution, right? Which, again, everyone around is like, you know, there's help for the pain you're feeling, the self-afflicted pain of what's in your head, or, again, the feelings of hopelessness and helplessness that goes along with suicidality. There is hope. There's talking. There's medication. There's people who care. And the situation is often not completely out of your control. There are things you can do to affect your behavior. But, again, this feeling of hopeless and helplessness makes people trapped. And yes, all of a sudden when people start putting their life in order and giving away possessions and they feel some sense of peace of here's the solution to my pain, I'm going to kill myself. That's obviously
they can have a week or a month of just calm and appearing positive and normal.
Right. But it's obviously, you know, it's better to connect with them in that anxious, agitated, depressed state because that's the real true self that what they're feeling. And then this peaceful self is, you know, again, an idea that I can't live on Earth anymore. I can't be alive, which is what the show is all about, trying to get people from taking that kind of action, that desperate action.
Yeah. A lot of people call and wonder, what is suicidal ideation? They don't get it. They don't really know what it is. I'm going to try. Here's an idea. Think of somebody that you care about right now and picture them. Picture them. Just see them. That's an idea. You've gone from what, before I mentioned that, to seeing something in your mind. You see the person dressed up and nice or whoever they are. Now you have an idea. Suicidal ideation is you're seeing yourself doing the act. Right, Kent? Do you find people have trouble putting words to the suicidal ideation?
Yeah, I think, again, either they have a specific plan or, you know, again, it's sort of like just the idea of just sleeping all day, right? Just, again, a typical question we therapists ask, which would be, would you just like to sleep all day or all weekend, which some people do, which, again, is not necessarily a sign that people are going to act on suicide, because I would even go out there and say there's help for people who are in so much psychic pain and feel so badly about themselves that they feel they'd be better off if they were dead, right? You know, even if they're not going to act on it because they feel guilty that it'll affect the people around them. But that's no way to go through your life, feeling that life is not a cabaret or joyful or the like, but life is suffering every day. It's suffering to be me going through my day every day because I'm trapped in my head.
Doesn't have to be. We have Lou on the line. Hello, Lou. Are you there?
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'm here.
So tell us about your experience.
My cousin, who we're near to each other in age, we're in our early 30s. He had just gotten out of prison. He did like a short prison sentence, and he was having a hard time finding work. He didn't have any. He couldn't provide for his family. He has children, and he felt like really frustrated and worthless. And by the time I found out that he was having suicidal thoughts, he was being hospitalized, and it was, I guess, like a psychiatric ward.
Yeah.
And he, I went to visit him, and there were a couple other family members that saw him, and he seemed to sort of be content that we were there and spending time with him. And eventually, a few weeks later, he got out, and we were speaking about it, and I wanted to try to talk to him and see if there's anything I could do. And I'm not a professional by any means. I'm like a working class guy. And so there are just a few things that I tried. And like one of them was, you know, I was just talking to him about like the mystery of like the future or like how that might be like a good thing. And also him having children, and that his life wasn't just his, it was theirs, and you know that he's responsible to them.
Yeah.
And also just the fear, like just speaking of myself, I'm like, well, I mean, it's like, what's gonna happen? Like there's the kind of fear aspect that I have that I was questioning him about. And he actually had, the point I'm trying to get to is he had a near-death experience when he was very young. He was shot.
Okay.
And he said that there was this bright light when I spoke to him about sort of the unknown. He was like, there was this bright light, and it was like the warmest feeling he's ever felt, and it felt really, really good.
Okay.
And it was like he's always been curious about that feeling. And it was interesting. He was not like upset or anything. He was very like calm and measured when he spoke to me, but it was like there was no convincing him, and he was just very interested
Where is he at now? So, I mean, that's a danger sign, too. I mean, he wants to get back to that feeling, right? I mean, are you worried?
Right.
So you're worried about that. So take
right,
me.
Yeah.
So did you listen to our whole show?
I was listening to some of it. I turned the radio off eventually when I was on hold. I don't know if you guys covered.
Okay,
some of that
so
stuff.
So it sounds like you can be present to him, and I think that's a good thing. That's your best gift, is just being with him, and he probably needs you around a lot lately, or you know, until he gets through this. I don't know what's his story right now, but you sound like a guy who can be present. My only suggestion is, you know, you don't want to become the convincer. You know, you're trying to persuade him to stay alive. He needs you to be present with him. That's the greatest gift you can give. If he wants to offer, you know, his thoughts about it and his fears and his things about it, you can emphasize all the beautiful reasons to stay alive, not why he should stay alive, like his kids or anything else, but the beautiful reasons for staying alive, like his kids. You know what I'm saying?
All right.
So, look, we got to run. We appreciate your call. If your friends has any trouble, he can give us a call, 212-757-4488. The National Suicide Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. Again, 1-800-273-8255. We want you around, folks. There's no reason why you shouldn't be. We'll see you next week.